Standing in the shadows of love, I'm getting ready for the heartaches to come. Can't you see me standing in the shadows of love? I'm getting ready for
Good morning, and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome William T. Volman, author of Shadows of Love, Shadows of Loneliness, a new two-volume collection of his visual art, including photographs, drawings, prints, and paintings from 1980 to 2022, published by Unnamed Press and Rare Bird Books. In addition to the visual, the two volumes feature Volman's commentary on his process as a photographer, printmaker, and painter, his subjects, drawn from his encounters with insurgents, refugees, prostitutes, police, and criminals, and the connections between these artistic and photographic projects and his books. Volman is the author of four collections of short fiction, a memoir, seven works of nonfiction, including the seven-volume essay on violence Rising Up and Rising Down, and 11 novels, including the National Book Award-winning Europe Central, and the five books currently available in his Seven Dreams series of historical fiction. Volman's journalism and stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, Granta, and many other publications. He's also the recipient of a Whiting Award and the Strauss Living Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. This is my fifth radio interview with Volman, going back to his short fiction collection Last Stories and Other Stories in 2014, and I always look forward to talking with him. Please join us for my conversation with Bill, which is already in progress. Bill, thanks for joining us today. This is our fifth interview, the first we've done remotely. I'm in Portland. You're calling in from Sacramento. Wish you were here.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for being a friend for so many years, Ken.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I always love seeing you. I always love talking with you. And this new two-volume set just gives me another excuse to do that. Now, the new two-volume set's kind of like a retrospective of your work, what you dub in the book My So-Called Career, and much of your life. And as a fan of your work, going back to my first read of the Rainbow Stories in the early 90s, it was fascinating to get the background and some context for many of your books, both the novels and nonfiction. How did these volumes come about? Were you approached by the publishers and your editor, Chris Heiser, Tyson Cornell?
Yeah, we were discussing it, and I had suggested something smaller, like maybe a facsimile edition of Book of Candles, and he proposed something larger, and he and Tyson were both very generous with giving me more and more plates. I kept saying, you know, let's do it right. And of course, I wish it had been about six or seven volumes, but I probably cost them enough money as it is.
Well, I know you write in the book, the real purpose of these two volumes is to present the maximum possible number of full-page plates. But I also found your commentary just as valuable. Well, of course, they're complimentary. Was that your idea to include the text, your commentary, which is generous and very open, very candid?
It was actually their idea. They wanted an essay about each one, and my first thought was just to get a bunch of plates out there and call it a day. And then once they asked me to do that, I thought, well, why not? And so I took my time and did my best. And here, Ken, unfortunately, I have to apologize to the readers for a couple of things that are not my fault and leave me very disappointed. I'm very, very thrilled, you know, that the books are out there and done, and they could have done a better job. The books were supposed to come out in 2020, which would have made a great deal of difference to my daughter Lisa, who really wanted to see it. They were delayed for 3 years. The delays were entirely the result of incompetence. Editorial incompetence. And I wouldn't have said anything about it except not too long ago, some fans showed me emails where they were blaming my grief for my daughter's death on their delays. And I consider that really vile and disgusting. And if they had kept their promise to me to just put up a general statement before the first interview that none of the delays were my fault, I would have kept quiet. But I have to stand up against that. I also have to say that the audiobook was released from a corrupt text without my knowledge, and I disavow it. I haven't ever seen it.
I haven't seen it either. They didn't send me that when they sent the print copies and the digital copies.
Yeah, I think it came out in January, but I have to disavow it. And when I mentioned that to Chris, you know, hey, what are you doing? He said, well, it wasn't in my control. Well, it certainly wasn't in mine. And finally, I do want to apologize for the fact that about 10% of the reproductions are a very poor quality, and it was completely unnecessary. In Volume 1, I mention illustrations 40, 157, and 249 that are unacceptably dark. And in Volume 2, 335 and 336 are unacceptably washed out. So that having been said, again, I apologize to the readers. I also apologize if the text has more errors in it. The copy editing was just a nightmare. And that having been said, now I can stop complaining.
I actually love the book, and it's your work, so you have every right to make those complaints, Bill. And I know every book you do, you're extremely careful, diligent in putting out the best possible version of that. And this fell a little short at times, but still, I think it's well worth what they're charging for. And I just learned a lot. I love looking at the prints. I wanted to first talk about the title, Shadows of Love, Shadows of Loneliness. In Volume 1, you reference three of the photos there, and you write, perhaps all that can be said about the three portraits is that they are shadows of love, shadows of loneliness. Why shadows, and why the love and loneliness?
Well, after all, we can never hope to create reality in a book or in art or in anything else. All we can hope to do is represent it, and our best efforts are going to be shadows of the truth and shadows of the good and of the beautiful. So they're not only shadows of love, they're also shadows of loneliness, because it is kind of a lonely thing to sit around writing books and printing pictures while the rest of the world goes on living.
Now, you refer to yourself in the book as a shadow who loves shadows.
Well, I am.
Yeah, who was that shadow Bill?
I don't know. Somebody maybe that I once was or would like to be, but of course I fall as short of being the person I want to be as I do when I'm trying to make the best picture I can.
I think you do a pretty good job, but I found this sentence interesting. It was a section in the text. You write, once my fifth grade science teacher asked me pityingly, Bill, do you ever live in the real world? Which is a terrible thing for a teacher to say, I think. And you reply, I cannot say for certain that I have ever visited that place, but I do think that served you well, not just in your photography and your artwork, but certainly in your fiction and nonfiction, in enabling you in a way to get into the characters' heads, characters like Chief Joseph, Eric the Red, the prostitutes that you write about in the Rainbow Stories, The Lucky Star.
No, and of course, I can't say that that I could really have gotten into Chief Joseph's head, but I got into the head of the best shadow of Chief Joseph that I could invent.
A very authentic one, or a very convincing one. And that was in the Dying Grass, which we did an interview for, an amazing book.
True enough.
Now, you dedicate Volume 1, which is a collection of photographs, to Lisa Jacobellis. I think, is that how it's pronounced, Jacobellis?
Jacobellis.
Yeah. Jacobellis. She's the archivist of your negatives at Ohio State University.
Yeah, she's a great lady.
How'd you connect with Lisa and decide Ohio State was a good home for your work?
I have a manuscript dealer named George Minkoff, who has been selling my papers to OSU for many years, although it looks like that is coming to an end now. I guess OSU doesn't want to buy my papers anymore, or not many of them, so I now have to find another institution. But it's been really, really good for many, many years, and Lisa's about to retire soon anyway, so maybe it's just as well that it comes to an end. But I'm very grateful to her and to OSU.
You have not just the prints and the negatives at OSU, but also, I think, in your studio and maybe other places. How did you decide what to include in the book? There was one line from your commentary: many kindred portraits whine in my ear like mosquitoes, demanding to be printed, matted, and boxed.
Oh, for sure, Ken. I mean, there are so many of my photo portfolios in particular that I would have liked to include. You know, still, I'm grateful to Chris and Tyson that they gave me as much space as they did.
And talking about influences, I know one for you is Ansel Adams. And my wife and I visited San Francisco earlier this summer. I don't know if you saw the Ansel Adams exhibit at the DeYoung.
I did, yeah. I thought it was really interesting. Although,
oh, yes.
Some of the curatorial commentary kind of grated on me.
Ah, that's so, always the case.
Yeah,
the artist and the critic.
About how, because of his work for the Sierra Club, then he's complicit in the dispossession of Native Americans. It's like, boy, you can't do anything right.
Well, you mentioned in the book that Ansel Adams used to say the negative is the score and the print the symphony. And I read someone once asked him why he left his negatives wherever he shot. And he said, this is a basis. I printed them one way and other people are going to print them another way. And you talk quite a bit in Volume 1 how your negatives can be interpreted when printed by you and especially other people, which is both a technical and creative process.
Yes. And Adams was always talking about what your final venue is going to be. Do you want to print your final print to look best in sunshine, you know, or in a darker gallery space? All this kind of stuff, it makes a significant difference. And since I print with a number of different formats and processes, I get different results each time. And the negative always contains much more information than we can see.
Oh, even when you print it?
Yes. So if you print it, let's say, as a platinum print, you're going to get all of these different gradations in the whites that you would never see anywhere else, but they're there. Or if you printed it as a cyanotype, you might see, for instance, a sign like in the background that's kind of blank and out of focus, and then you tone that cyanotype in lead acetate, and suddenly you can read what the sign says. So it's really fascinating and incredible, but basically the amount of information in a high-quality silver gelatin negative is, I won't say it's infinite, but it's abundantly infinite.
And that turns the person who makes the print into somewhat of an artist, determining
right, yeah,
what to bring forward and what to kind of leave in the negative.
Yeah, that's right, Ken. Yeah, have you ever done any work in a darkroom?
No, one of my first jobs out of college was a photo typesetter, which is an obsolete job for Fred Meyer here in Portland.
Oh, wow.
And they had a dark room and everything, and I had to learn how to do that. Of course, it's all done digitally now. So whatever expertise I developed, no pun intended, is lost or useless now.
Well, let's see. So you were probably, preparing things for newspaper ads?
Exactly. Newspaper ads. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. That means you are well on your way to being a gum printer, because basically when you finish clearing a gum print, all the little bits of gum resolve into dots of different kinds, just like in a newspaper.
Wow. And you go into a technical description of gum printing in the book.
Yeah, why not?
You refer to it as the bichromate. The bichromate.
That's right.
The bichromate, yep. Superior detail of 20th century silver gelatin photography. I mean, that's what you contrast it with. And you talk about the kind of using it for visuals that are simple enough or mysterious enough
Right.
An ad is certainly simple enough. It's not very mysterious.
Right. And yeah, they can be very moody and painterly and so forth. Many people don't like them because, you know, people who are used to eating Hostess Twinkies all the time may think that, you know, an ordinary blackberry is just not sweet enough.
It's also has its hazards. I think you said many are the happy times when I've left the dark room retching.
Yeah, that's true.
So something to watch out for. That's something I don't think I had as a photo typesetter, fortunately, or maybe I did. I was exposed, but they didn't let me know.
Well, you're still alive, so hopefully you are safe.
So far, so good. Now, the pictures must have sparked a few memories, Bill, not only of the places you've been, people you met, but what you were like at the time. There was a really interesting picture of you as a younger Volman in the 1980s from your days as an anti-nuclear activist in college. You were protesting at the Seabrook nuclear plant in New Hampshire. And you write, "Nowadays, this representation of my young self makes me smile a little because it reminds me that I truly went to that place." So that's a pleasant memory.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah. And most of the photographs and paintings and so forth that I look at are pleasant memories, even if they were unpleasant to make at the time. You know, there are some that are just so horrific that I have no fun looking at them, and I left most of those out of these books.
Yeah, well, there's quite a few from your travels during the Bosnian War and then in Soviet-occupied Afghanistan. And you wrote, "I go where I go, feeling a proud duty to approach, witness, and respect suffering in the hope of improving my surroundings." That's been a theme throughout your work, but it must take its toll mentally and I'm sure physically when you put yourself in harm's way like that.
Well, you know, I'm near the end of my career now, and so needless to say, most of the things that I hope to do, I didn't do well enough or long enough, and that's just how it is, you know, with human affairs. We do our best, and it's certainly better than not doing our best. But
you've done pretty well, Bill. You've got quite a great body of work, the novels, the nonfiction, and now the visual art.
Well, I wish I'd done better, but anyway.
I think we all have that desire. Now, you include a reader's caveat in an introductory note to Volume 1. You write, "Several images in this and the art volume, Volume 2, are by some definitions, in parentheses, not mine, obscene. For much of my life, I was lucky enough to live in an ever more sex-accepting society. Nowadays, artists, and especially writers, have become vulnerable to censorship, name-calling, and even the destruction of their careers in retaliation for words and behavior which were previously tolerated." How has this affected you and your work? I know one example where you had to change the title of your last novel, The Lucky Star. The original title was The Lesbian.
Right. And you know better than anyone, you know, the dishonest shenanigans that Viking pulled at Powell's. You were the one who found out that They had told me that Powell's didn't want me. They were offended by the book. And then I found out from you that they told Powell's that I was too busy. So that's the kind of thing that...
Yeah, that was the publisher. I would say that when I got contacted Jeremy at Powell's, he was extremely happy that you wanted to read there and didn't really have to think twice. It was, yes, right. Tell him to come.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I get stuff like that from time to time. And, you know, we all get it. I get it from neighbors telling me, oh, no, Bill, no, you don't mean a Chinese. You mean a Chinese person. You don't mean a blonde. You mean a blonde woman. You don't mean a pregnant woman. You mean a pregnant person. And I think that the left and the right are both allies in blighting freedom of speech.
I would say both extremes, definitely. Now, about the Lucky Star, and this went on throughout when I was reading the commentary, there were just all these great insights to your creative process and the story behind some of your books. There was one set of block prints where you were illustrating Bible verses, and you came up with the idea while doing research in Jamaica. You got the idea of portraying Jesus as a woman, and that led to your Christ-like character, Neva, in The Lucky Star. What was the inspiration in Jamaica, and how did that lead to the novel?
Well, there was a man I had been asked to write about for Rising Up and Rising Down, Richard Albert, who talked about how it was a good thing in Jamaica to have black representations of Christ, because Christ belongs to everybody. And the beef that I've often had with the whole Judeo-Christian stuff is that, you know, women don't get that their due. And if I were going to imagine God incarnated as a person, I would be much more interested in worshiping a goddess, you know, than some man.
And I think at least half the population would too.
Yeah, why not, huh? I mean, you're a happily married man, so you're happy with your goddess.
My goddess, yes.
So it was a no-brainer to just say female and female, she created them, and so on and so forth. And just, I think it actually conveys pretty much the same meaning from these, you know, that the Bible does. It's just a slightly different way of representing it and giving the feminine a chance, you know, whenever I can.
Yeah, and we see those kind of early prints that you did with Jesus as a woman in the book, but also some of the ones you did for The Lucky Star, including a beautiful fold-out in Volume 2. I think what you intended for the cover with Neva, the Christ-like character, in the middle, and all her acolytes or apostles in a way that she serviced and served were surrounding her.
Yeah, that's right. So Viking wasn't going to put that on the jacket. They offered to print it on the frontispiece, but then I figured that would be something about the size of a matchbook cover, and so it would probably just be a very, very dark rectangle with nothing visible.
Now we mentioned the photographs in Volume 1 from your days, the young Bill Volman as an anti-nuclear activist in New Hampshire in college. And we also mentioned Rising Up and Rising Down, which I don't know, for some reason you describe it in the book as your longish essay on violence, which doesn't do it justice. It's exhaustively researched work spanning 7 volumes on the use of violence and when it's justified, when it's not. How did your experience at Seabrook lead to what I think you consider one of maybe your most important book, not one of your most important books?
Well, Ken, when the affinity groups at Cornell were forming and proselytizing and so forth, they said, you know, the chances of a serious nuclear accident are high, and we want to stop the plant before it creates a lot of environmental and human damage. So I first of all noticed that, of course, nonviolence against the organized violence of the state is probably going to lose, which is what happened. And then I started thinking, well, was it right or wrong, you know, that the plant was in fact built and commissioned for a while and so forth. And I thought the only way to answer that would be through the principles of proportionality and discrimination. Proportionality means that if you're in a war and, let's say, the enemy has killed or is about to kill 10,000 of your side, if you can kill less than 10,000 from their side to stop it, it's probably not so bad. But if you're killing a million to save your 10,000, maybe that's excessive. And discrimination would be, oh, you know, like when Osama attacked us on September 11th, and so we decided to react by killing hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who had nothing to do with it. That's an example of very, very poor discrimination. And so that's why I would call certainly Iraq War II a war crime, because it was a crime which was fought without a verified war aim. And therefore, you know, it was just killing.
And that math, those numbers that you mentioned are important, because what you come up with in this multi-volume book is something that you call a moral calculus to justify exactly using violence or to continue to be nonviolent.
Right. So that was when I started really thinking about this at Seabrook. And I thought, well, these are very, very ugly questions, and they make people uncomfortable to even ask them. But the fact is that governments, militaries, terrorists, all kinds of people are making those calculations. So why don't we just look at what they are? And in the case of a nuclear plant, suppose that you had an extremely reliable estimate that said that within 10 years or something, the nuclear plant was going to fail and kill 10,000 people, then would proportionality and discrimination justify some sort of a violent attack on the nuclear plant that might kill people who work for the plant? They might even kill civilians, but they would be far less than 10,000 people. And it doesn't matter at this point whether you think that makes sense or whether that's abhorrent. The important thing is to say, well, are we willing to talk about this at all? How are we willing to decide when violence is justified and when it isn't? It's got to be by thinking through some of these really icky, frightening, sad, disgusting things.
And you didn't just think it through or think about it. You actually visited a lot of these very precarious, dangerous, some might say death-defying situations, including almost getting killed in the Bosnian War, getting blown up in a Jeep there, a number of situations where it's amazing that you're still around.
Yeah, well, everyone makes mistakes, Ken.
Well, you did say that, and we'll talk about that maybe a little later, about your insight is instant and accurate, and that has protected you in a lot of situations.
Yeah, so far. everything comes to an end, but it hasn't ended yet.
Now, let's go to, and this is a constant theme in your work, throughout your work, and certainly in these two volumes of your collected artwork. You write about taking pictures with and without consent, and you usually pay your subjects, as with the photos of prostitutes in Bogota, Colombia, as San Francisco's Tenderloin, which a neighborhood you've featured in several of your books, all the way back to the Rainbow Stories up to the Lucky Star. What are your personal guidelines for taking photos candidly without explicit consent, and when do you opt for paid consent?
I offer for explicit consent whenever possible. For paid consent, if someone is poor, it'll make a difference. If I see, for instance, a drunk sleeping in the street, and I think, okay, somehow there might be a way of raising compassion for the situation, and I'll take a picture, then I'll think about it, and I might take it, and later I might look at it and think, oh, no, this makes the person look too vulnerable, I won't use it, or, yeah, this seems okay to me. When I'm at some political demonstration or there's some sort of military parade or a war event, some battle or something like that, you can't ask people's consent.
Oh, no.
So then you just have to say, okay, this is a public event and I'm going to document it.
Talking about that, that decision you have to make, you include a series of photos of a sex worker in Colombia smoking something highly addictive and apparently poisonous called Bazuco.
That's right. Yeah, we should have some, Kat.
Well, you who have tried almost everything declined when you had the chance to try Bazuco,
yeah.
Right?
And yeah, that's right. I just as soon keep the few brain cells that I have.
So you know, it's kind of very extreme on the scale of recreational drugs. And you wonder if you're exploiting this sex worker, maybe putting her in danger of arrest. Then you ask the reader through your commentary, do I really like to help people, or am I actually useless, or even worse? Have you answered that question for yourself? I know I would say that you really like to help people. I don't find you useless or worse, but I guess you're the one who counts.
Right. I do my best, and I also know that the instant we think that we found the answer and we're in the right, that's when we're likely to start making mistakes. So it's important to keep interrogating myself and make sure that I'm doing the best that I can. And it's also important for me to understand that many people would disagree with any particular stance that I took. Whether I said, oh, I have the right to take pictures of anyone without consent, or I never have the right to take pictures of any animate objects, which is what, you know, a Talib would say. Whatever you do, people are not going to be happy. And I figure I don't have that much time in the world. And so
to convince everybody else.
Exactly, yeah. So I'm going to do the best I can to try to create the work I think is important. And I will try to make sure that I am, you know, doing what feels right for my conscience. And then I'm just going to hope that I don't make too many mistakes and keep doing what I'm doing and not get too upset if someone says, oh, Bill, you know, you can't use the word lesbian unless you're a lesbian. How dare you take a picture of a woman unless you're a woman? I just don't pay much attention.
No, that is a bit extreme, but I have heard that.
Yeah.
I want to give an example of helping people, but maybe also some people would think that you're exploiting them. Let's go back to the more prosperous days of print journalism. So about 30 years ago, you pitched a story to Spin magazine about traveling to Thailand with your friend Ken Miller to free a child sex slave. And the publisher, Bob Guccione Jr., said, yes, go ahead, Bill, and paid for it. And you include several drawings for that trip in Volume 2. Can you tell that story, how you went about finding the sex slave, freed her?
We just kept running around to pimps and brothels saying, no, we really want young girls. And no one had any problem with it. Finally, yeah, we got a 12-year-old, and I said, well, are you happy with your job? No, I hate it. I want to get out of here. So we took her in and put her in a school.
Well, there's a story between taking her and putting her in the school. You and Ken, it's almost something out of a movie.
Well, yeah, we kidnapped her fair and square. thanks to Bob Guccione, he came up with some money to pay for this girl's tuition. And I've always been proud of the fact that I rescued one person.
Well, yeah, it's amazing. Have you ever followed up with her? You knew what school she was going to, and she was learning a trade and all that.
Yeah.
Of course, at the age of 12.
I followed up for a little while, yeah. I visited her father with a squad of Thai soldiers to scare him into not selling more of his daughters. And he said that he needed a new roof, and now what he wanted was to start a pig farm, and then he wouldn't sell any more daughters. So he needed $100 for his pig farm. I gave it to him and then went back and checked on him later on, and he gambled it away.
well, at least he didn't sell any more daughters.
Who knows? Yeah. Anyway, I did what little I could. Yeah.
We mentioned earlier when we were talking about some of the shortcomings of the book that your daughter Lisa died during, I think, the editorial period while you were waiting for it to come out from 2020.
Yeah, she died in 2022. Yeah.
And you mentioned in a footnote that she died during the book's lengthy editorial process. If it's all the same to you, I will leave my love for her in the present tense.
Right, because the book, as I said, was supposed to come out in 2020. And then they just kept mucking it up year after year after year. And suddenly, Lisa wasn't alive anymore. And I thought, what, do I have to rewrite that now?
Yeah, you know, I never met her, but I knew her through you. Sometimes when we talked on the phone, she was there in the room with you. And I think everyone who heard you speak about her or saw you together knew how much you loved her. Did you want to talk about her at all, your loss, or maybe, as you say, just leave your love for her in the present tense?
Yeah, I mean, there's not much to say, Ken. She's dead, and that's just how it is. One of her relatives said, "Don't worry, Bill, she's in a better place now." And I said, "Absolutely right. She's in a box on top of the piano."
Yes. I have my parents in a little box on top of a bookshelf, so I know.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, you wonder if there is any consciousness in the ashes. Which is worse, huh? To be stuck in a box where it's dark and you can't breathe, or dumped all over the place and then all the little bugs are going to eat you? It's hard to
Right. Now, you went into that, our first interview, actually. It was in 2014 for your fiction collection, Last Stories and Other Stories.
Oh, yeah.
Which was basically on the theme of death and dying. And boy, you had one story in there where death was being in a box staring up at the ceiling for eternity. Small space, yeah. Dark. Now, I asked you about a defining moment in your life at that point, losing your younger sister when you were 9, she was 6. You said you felt enormous guilt. You were haunted by nightmares. You were being chased by your sister's skeleton each time you tried to sleep. And you've mentioned
this
in previous books. But in the new collection, you tell a part of the story I haven't heard, how you finally felt some relief and, as an added benefit, learned to trust that hyper-accurate and instant intuition. When I asked you if it was okay to bring it up, you said it might help others going through similar situations. Can you talk a little bit about that? It involves a therapist and your dad.
Well, I always wondered why I felt so much guilt. And a therapist said, "Bill, you know, you're imagining things. Your parents don't really blame you." And it turns out that they did, you know, when I asked. So then I did feel some relief. Okay, I understand where these feelings are coming from, and I can decide, you know, whether how much of the guilt I want to accept for my own and how much I want to offload on my parents or whatever. It doesn't really matter. But I think the worst thing with some kind of tragedy is tiptoeing around it. I very much believe, you know, in the Freudian power of repression. Well, Jung would say the same thing, too, that by definition, all the unconscious is the stuff that you are not conscious of. And since the universe is a pretty big place and, you know, our brains are not that big, it stands to reason that most of our experiences are in the unconscious at any particular time.
And I think Jung would use a very appropriate term, since we're talking about these two books, the shadow.
For sure. Yeah, he definitely would. Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever read Shadow and Evil in Fairy Tales by...
Bruno Bettelheim, was it?
No, it was Marie Louisa von France. She was one of his.
Oh, no, no. I've heard about the book, but I have not read that.
It's a really, really good book. But anyway, so, of course, the death of someone we love, you know, needs to be pushed down into the shadow for much of the time so that we can actually function. You know, it's like when a rape victim dissociates. When something terrible happens and you have to get on with your life, you dissociate. And dissociation is really important and necessary. But if you never stop dissociating, that unconscious content has a way of taking its revenge. You can only keep it down for so long.
And we live in a society where we don't want to face death, or even, I think most people don't even think they're going to die, or theoretically they do, but reality, they said, no, it's not going to happen to me.
Well, I mean, you and I, we're not going to die, right? You promise me?
Oh, I promise.
Oh, thanks. Okay, now I'm not worried.
put your mind at ease.
That's right. So, you know, that's what I would say that maybe would help others, that that it's important, you know, to dig down into the grave, into the mud, and just face it every now and then. If you can do that, it's going to make it easier when next time comes. And there's always going to be a next time as long as we're alive.
And I would recommend that last stories and other stories for readers who are looking for that experience, where you kind of face it down in these fictions, these short stories.
Oh, well, thank you. That's nice of you.
Now, your latest novel, so something a little more upbeat here, is called A Table for Fortune. It's currently in manuscript. It's another big book, probably over 1,000 pages when it hits print. And in the Shadows volume, you include several pieces of art for the book, which takes place partly in the Sacramento Delta, not too far from where you live, your home. And I remember you researching the book at the Multnomah County Library when you were in Portland just before the pandemic. So like March 2020. Have you finished the manuscript? Is the novel ready to go?
Oh, yeah. Right now, let's see, my Italian publisher sounds very interested, and there's a German publisher that is also interested. If they can find a third European publisher, they might be able to get funding from the EU Ministry of Culture, because they estimate the translation cost will be over €1 million.
And now, what about an English language version, though?
Well, one of the many wonderful things that happened last year, I mean, not quite as much fun as Lisa's death, but still it was pretty fun when, after 40 odd years or so, Viking fired me. I did not want to compromise, as always, so I dug in my heels, and they were saying, oh, you know, there are too many fonts in the book. Really, you know, I've spent several years making sure that the fonts are an important aspect of the book, just as the positions are in Dying Grass. And
We did an interview on that, and the way you laid out the page, the fonts, but also the indentation was very important in the white space.
Right. Yeah. So if they had said, no, Bill, you just have to make that a standard paragraph sort of book, I would have refused. That would have really screwed it up. And the same thing with these fonts. You know, there's one kind of font that it's sort of a typewriter style. And when you see that, you know, oh, this is like a diplomatic cable or a CIA report or a Stasi report. And then there is it's a certain kind of boldface, you know, that stands for a political slogan. And italic might be for, you know, booming TV news or whatever. So anyway.
Well, this all helps the reader. I'm thinking they must have had a font calculus. These number of fonts are okay, but Bill's asking too much if we exceed this number.
Well, apparently they can only license the fonts now, so I'm told. They can't buy them anymore, so every time they use them, they have to pay. It's like the way that some of my friends have to license Microsoft Word, and they can only use it on the cloud. So.
Oh, that's right. It's a subscription model now. It's used to be able to buy it outright. It was yours forever.
Yeah, and I will never, ever accept the subscription model. So I'm still limping along with one of my old laptops that's now missing two keys, so I have to plug in a keyboard. And I just think, no, I am not accepting that model. Never, never.
It's made life a lot more expensive. Everything subscription now, cable TV, well, not cable TV, but streaming services, software, just made things a lot more expensive than when I was growing up. I feel sorry for younger people today.
Yeah, and it's not more just more expensive, but it's also a way of these greed heads knowing more and more about you and your data.
Oh, yeah, collecting information, that's a big part of it.
Yeah, so I won't do it.
Now, a few other books you mentioned in the new collection, besides A Table for Fortune, you said you're working on a book-length photo essay, collecting your pictures of heroes and heroines, printing them from your archive of negatives. And these heroes and heroines are people that we wouldn't traditionally think of as heroes and heroines. You're the ones featured in myths and fairy tales and stories. Who are these heroes and heroines to you?
Some of the blue-collar workers who I've gotten privileged to know, like my exterminator. They do things that would kill me to do. There was one time not too long ago when he was in an attic and he saved an electrician who had already passed out from heat stroke. And my contractor, Rob, who was helping me replace the roof back in 2007, I've seen him lift this ceiling beam. I don't know how many hundreds of pounds it has. And he supported it all on his shoulder.
Well, that's like superhero. heroic. Yeah, amazing. And you mentioned some of the people you met in your travels. I think an example is a Congolese woman carrying water to her home. A very heavy load over a long distance. A boy in Pakistan selling onions by the side of the road.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And, yeah, I was hoping, I don't know whether I'll ever get to it now, but I did want to bring out a long book. It was just going to be about work and workers. And so many of those people would be in it. I have a whole section on people carrying burdens. A lot of the time they're women, in Colombia or the Congo, you can see these ladies carrying big pitchers of water on top of their heads without holding it. It's really impressive. So, yeah, it would be nice to honor those people, but maybe someone else can print those after I'm gone.
You have a quote in the book about that projected series called Work, Photos. You write, I may never finish, and maybe I just will, although I am poor health these days. I'm in poor health these days. And I know you've said the same about finishing your Seven Dreams series of novels. There's five published, two to go. You've always been so dedicated and productive and still seem to be relentlessly so. Can you talk about your health bill and how it's affecting your work now?
Well, I'm a cancer survivor. Quite a bit of my intestines were removed, so I'm constantly nauseated and ill, and traveling is harder. And Lisa's death sort of knocked the stuffing out of me.
It would any parent.
Yeah, I suppose so. And since I'm not going to work with Viking again, evidently, I'm thinking, well, do I even really want to bring out any more Seven Dreams when they'd be with some other publisher and it may not look uniform and so forth. But the other thing is just that, as we were saying earlier, Ken, it just gets more and more difficult to do any sort of literary or artistic project in this country and not be punished for it. I feel very, very lucky that I never got punished with the Seven Dreams for so-called appropriation. There was one point with Fathers and Crows, when a Native American got up and started saying, "Now I've listened to what Bill said about the League of the Iroquois," I was going, "Uh-oh." And then he said, "Well, and everything he said is correct."
Wow. What a compliment.
Yeah. But nowadays, you know, do you remember, Ken, this was, what, 3 or 4 years ago? I remember seeing it in one of the alternative papers in Portland. There was some Anglo couple that opened a...
Yes. They got a recipe, I think, for was it burritos or some kind of Mexican food? And
right.
Then they were accused of
appropriation.
Yeah, colonialism in a way when it comes to food. That's interesting because I had a friend do... an interview with a chef who traveled around the country looking at different ethnic foods. And we asked him about it. And he, just like a lot of writers, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of giants. And he said, that's how cooking works. That's how food works. You take something and then you make a variation on it. You try to make it yourself. You get inspired by it. And he was very much against the concept of appropriation, of calling somebody appropriating another culture.
Right. I mean, if there is such a thing, it's a good thing. I believe in syncretism. We're in a syncretic world. If people are going to say, "Oh, Bill, you know, you can't write this or you can't say this because you're not this gender or that race," I don't give a shit. I really don't. And it's only getting harder and harder for people like me. So now I'm old and tired and, you know, sad about climate change and the death of my daughter. And I'll just keep on doing my best. But I'm very glad I'm not on the internet. So if someone wants to rant and rave about what a
yes.
Appropriate, I am. Hopefully, I'll never hear it.
You're much better off. The social media in particular has become just a cesspool. I mean, you could say the most innocent comment, and people will jump all over you.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
But in any case, Bill, I always think of you as the Keith Richards of literature. Despite multiple events that would have killed an ordinary person, you're still here, and I think you'll outlive us all. As I promised, you'll live forever.
Well, I think of you then as the Mick Jagger of radio.
I don't know about that, but I accept the compliment. Thank you very much. Bill, is there anything else you want to say about the two volumes? I know we've been talking for a while, and it's my pleasure to talk with you. It's you're just an amazing person to know. So down to earth, such a great sense of humor, and yet look at this incredible body of work. Some of the greatest books ever published.
Oh, well, thank you, Ken. I guess, do you feel that, I mean, I don't want to be too much of a Debbie Downer. Do you think that my criticisms at the beginning of the publisher were fair? You know, I almost never talk that way, but I thought, I just feel so bad for the readers that keep asking me why they haven't come out and all this stuff that I had to say it.
No, I think it's very fair, but I would add my take on the two volumes. They're well worth whatever the publisher's charging for them. I learned so much. And you mentioned about 10% of the prints, the photographs and some of the drawings and the sketches. I would say the other 90% are just pristine. And
oh, thank you. That's music to my ears, yeah.
I have so much more appreciation of you, actually, as a painter, in addition to being a photographer. I mean, there's some beautiful reproductions in the book of your paintings, very colorful, very vivid, and it does you justice.
Well, some of the people that I worked with were extremely diligent, and many, many people tried their best, and so... In spite of my criticisms, I'm grateful and I'm happy that the books are finally out. I'm going to do one more interview on Friday with Jordan Rothacker's podcast, and then I may say enough is enough, but you are the first, and I'm really happy that I get to talk to you about it.
Oh, well, thank you. I feel honored. Bill, thanks so much for talking to us today. If you were here in the studio with me in Portland, I'd invite you out for a beer next time.
I'd love that.
Next time, I hope.
Oh, well, thank you, my friend. You are the kindest person, and you've done a lot for me in my career, and you were the one, you know, as I said, who got to the bottom of the nasty thing that Viking was doing with the lesbian.
It wasn't that hard to get to the bottom of it, just contacting pals. But I know you had a lot of fans there, and we went out, as you usually do, we went out afterwards, and everybody had a beer and got to talk and meet you, and it was a great experience.
Well, it was great for me, and you made it possible.
Well, thank you for that, Bill. I hope to see you soon in person.
Oh, thank you, Ken. And I hope that you have a good rest of your day.
Oh, thanks, Bill. Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director, you can listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, William T. Volman, author of Shadows of Love, Shadows of Loneliness, a new two-volume collection of his visual art from 1980 to 2022, published by Unnamed Press and Rare Bird Books. You can learn more about the new books online at rarebirdlit.com. Just a note that KBOO is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. It's our fall membership drive, so there's no better time to show your support for the station and programming like this by becoming a member yourself or renewing your membership. If you donate now, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $14,000, thanks to the generous support of a group of KBOO donors. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. usually. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, October 26th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
what'll I do with Jonesy? When I'm alone with only dreams of you that won't come true, what'll I do?